Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore the leading edge of a changing paradigm. And one of the most interesting topics that I've come across is this idea of synchronicity. And it's not an idea, but it's something that occurs in many people's lives over and over again. And there really hasn't been any plausible explanation I have come across, well, at least until I've met tonight's guest, Gibbs Williams. He's a psychoanalyst for 43 years and also been investigating synchronicities for 50 years. He's the author of Demystifying Meaningful Coincidences, Synchronicities, The Evolving Self, and The Personal Unconscious and the Creative Process. Actually, I'm really looking forward to reading that book. Gibbs, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Glad I met you.
Yes, it's been very nice, our ongoing conversations, and I want to sort of pick up where we left off, even though the rest of the audience hasn't been in on the conversation, but I think they'll get the idea. When we were talking about synchronicities, you mentioned something called experiential logic. Now, can you go into that, what that means, and then trace back its connection to synchronicities?
I will try. The usual way anybody generates meaning, whether it's a special meaning like a synchronicity, which is really a special, it's a fancy word for extra special, meaningful coincidence. The way we generate meanings, usually, is through cause and effect logic. So we impose order on things that happen to us. We take A and B, relate them together, and we either draw some kind of a causal connection or more often a correspondence or an association. This is the way we generate meanings on anything. That is linear logic.
It's human to generate meaning. I mean, we are meaning-making machines, so things happen. And in order to make our world safe and predictable, we create a meaning. It might not always be the right meaning, not that there could be a wrong meaning, but meaning is what humans do, right?
Yes. In order to survive and hopefully thrive, we make meanings. We relate facts together, draw conclusions to help make us feel secure, predict things. When we do it in a real fancy, controlled way, it's called scientific method. This has worked enormously well. It continues to work enormously well. However, as is current in this whole war that's going on, de facto war between scientific method and spirituality, there is obviously limitations to this thing with respect to registering anomalous experiences, and it certainly applies to the issue of trying to understand in an objective way how synchronicities or meaningful coincidences come about. And I thought in my trying to understand what this is about, Jung, who is the titular head of the synchronicity scene for the last 54 years, indicates that when you try to relate the subjective part of a coincidence together with the objective part, the subjective with the objective, the inner with the outer, he says, he comes up with a startling conclusion that no way in this world can linear logic or simple causality, scientific causality, make any rational sense out of how A and B get connected. So the problem of the linkage between A and B, internal and external, is really the major issue to trying to understand objectively the nature of coincidences. And indeed, he comes up with the startling conclusion that not only can you not use scientific logic, linear logic, to make the linkage, it's not even conceivable in rational terms. And that is an incredibly provocative assertion, and one which I, having been a major in philosophy at Columbia, it just didn't make sense to me. And in fact, what Hume does is throw out causality and adopts a principle of acausality, which to me is a nonsense term. There's got to be some kind of causality, but he throws out conventional linear logic. I came up with an idea that there is another way of viewing causality, which leads to my idea of experiential logic.
Experiential
logic is a way of adding linear logic, which is essentially thinking, critical thinking, in addition to messy feelings that are often contradictory, plus intuitions, plus chance, anything else you can experience, and add it all into the pot, and you get what I call experiential logic.
Okay, but that, I think, going back to what Jung said, there might be other factors involved, like a higher spiritual connection, and you just can't also throw out the word intuition and think it means something. I mean, that's a whole ball of wax, in a way, intuitions. You just can't say, oh, it's intuition, because that's not using any scientific basis at all. I do think Jung was onto something by saying there's another causal factor that you cannot explain with your rational linear mind, and we have other ways of thinking and other ways of knowing. They may be intuitive, but you have to also explain what intuition means. So are you following me?
Yes, what he does is to say there is a half explanation of using what he would call psychodynamic understanding to explain the subjective element in a coincidence. And then he says there's an external factor, you're quite right, that he would call, and I think it fits under the common term of a spiritual element or an occult element, in which he says these things come about when there's an activation of an archetype, and that this archetype is derived from his idea of the collective unconscious, which he believes is over and above rational thinking and subsists in a absolute area of what he calls absolute meaning, and that in effect, if I understand this correct, that in a synchronicity, people are actually channeling wisdom from this archetypal subsistent area of experience that transcends interpretation. So in other words, it's collective wisdom that's really out there, and when you have a synchronicity, presumably you are channeling and intuiting the feelings and the information that is coming from this activated archetype.
Okay, wait. Let me just hold it there for a second. Now, I don't think Jung used the word channeling, but I do say when there is a synchronicity like that, it does feel like you are cosmically connected to a greater causality, a greater being, a greater purpose. There's something transcendent that happens in synchronicities, and I believe it even happened to you in some of the personal synchronicities that you told me about. Before the mind came in and tried to explain it, there was this cosmic, oh my God, right? I mean,
well, let me just go back to channeling for a minute. You're correct. He doesn't use the word channeling. On the other hand, he does use the idea that when you are in the midst of a big deal synchronicity, he uses terms like you are gripped by numinosity. It is not something that is mental. It is essentially intuited, and it comes in very strong feelings of what I call a magical, mystical. He uses the term numinosity. So from my vantage point, this bypasses interpretation.
Well, wouldn't you agree with the synchronicities that you related to me? Wouldn't you agree in that moment where it all came together, there was a transcendence that happened?
May I briefly tell the synchronicity?
Yes.
Right.
Please,
this is the second one I had. Now, this is important to go back to the origin of these things from me. I was a truth-seeking 19-year-old. By truth-seeking, I mean I must have been wired to be interested in philosophical issues such as, who am I, what am I doing here, what's my purpose? And I picked up an interest in philosophy very early on. And these guys made enormous sense to me from 2,000 years ago, like Plato and Aristotle. It made more sense than my compatriots who were contemporary. However, as truth-seeking as I was, that's how confused I was. So between my confusion and my truth-seeking, I started to keep a journal, which was an attempt to order my chaos, as many people try to do. In the midst of it, I started recording what turned out to be 19, what I call specially meaningful coincidences, synchronicities, beginning with 19 years old and stretching for approximately 20 years. I would have, they were either interspersed like 5-6 months. Occasionally they would happen right on top of each other. More often it went like 7 years or whatever. The second one that I had was the one you're referring to, which really, in my view, really was a mind blower. Briefly, I was part of a spiritual, I attended a spiritual, the First Spiritualist Church of New York, which met in the Ansonia Hotel on Sundays, and I went dutifully because of, A, the people that I met there that attended were extraordinarily interesting, and B, I liked the ceremony in which the first half of the service was a kind of, you know, folksy Protestant thing, and then it got jazzed up at the second part, where people would write down questions that they wanted to address to so-called spirit, put them into a little hat. The hat would be given to the medium of the week, who was usually a little old lady who would blindfold herself, and she would reach in, pull out a message, blindfolded, and then purportedly give messages from so-called spirit that would be in the form of your aunt says you're doing fine and you're going to be a poet one day and keep doing what you're doing and all your dead relatives are near you and they love you. And then they would jazz it up with master teachers and lessons from spirit.
You didn't believe any of that, or you were skeptical?
I think I was split down the middle. I think I was intrigued. The group that went attended were extremely interesting. There was a psychiatrist who I met who purportedly went into trance and channeled poetry from Freud and Jung. There was a little old medium, 85 years old, who was told by spirit to do art, and she got an exhibition in three museums, having, at 85 years old, taken instructions from so-called spirit and done spirit drawings, and in 3 weeks, one of the people who was an agent took her things around, and she was instantly famous. So this kind of thing, my search for something bigger than me. I had a need to be saved. I wanted to feel that there was that the world was populated, or the reality was energized with what I would call spirit and divinity. I was looking. I wanted there to be evidence that this kind of thing was really real. So that however, I was also skeptical. So I was sort of split down the middle, and I would call myself a searching skeptic. In the midst of this, okay. I got invited to go to a seance with this lady and 10 other people. And I went to her New York apartment in Central Park West, small little apartment. It was a little alcove, and 10 of my compatriots and me sitting around a circle with Agatha leading the group. And the lights went out, and she said, "Say what comes to mind." And in my mind's eye, I had a really incredible experience. I have never duplicated this sense, in which it seemed as if there was a round, an ovular shape, and in the circle, it was a kind of yellow glow, and in that yellow glow was what I called a grandmotherly face, and Agatha said, "How do you know it's a grandmother?" And I said, "Because she has granny glasses." And then she said, who does this belong to? And I was excited, having met a very attractive girl next to me, and I sort of facetiously turned to her and I said, well, it's obvious who the glasses belong to. This is Diane's grandmother. And Diane next to me mm-hmm. perked up and said, yeah, I have those granny glasses on my mantelpiece. And this was this was rather interesting. This was novel. I never had a course like this at Columbia. And I was excited. Now, that was the beginning of what turned out to be a quite remarkable next few hours that leads to the second synchronicity. I left there.
Okay, but first I just want to ask, was
sure.
your feeling that of wonder and amazement?
Oh, I was very excited. I thought something big time was happening. I never had experience like that. I didn't know what to make of it. And I had what most people have when they have these kinds of occult occurrences. If they're really impressive and they seem authentic, and this one certainly did, I think I would call it a head-scratching event. I was full of wonder and awe, very excited. I had no idea what was going on. I just went with the flow. So I came out,
right.
And I had a question, and the question that I had brought with me that I guess I asked a lot of people was, do miracles exist? And somebody said, upon leaving, if you want to know the answer, I'll tell you the answer. Go home, and if you have a New Testament, which I happen to have had, they said, ask your question, in this case, do miracles exist? Open the Bible, and at the first thing you see consciously, take it as your answer. So excitedly, I go home, I ask the question, I open the Bible, and the first thing my eye hits consciously was the part of the Bible that describes the raising of Lazarus, which was a miracle. Now, I took that as, that was doubly exciting, or it continued the excitement, but I used it as an excuse to call Diane and tell mm-hmm. her this interesting news, which I did, and I said, what an incredible coincidence I had. And she says, well, let me tell you my coincidence. I said, okay, go right ahead. She said that very afternoon she had been walking in the park with her obviously unconventional psychiatrist, who turns out to be this guy who purportedly channels Freud and Jung information. And she said he told her that in a past life he was at the raising of Lazarus. When I heard that okay. second raising of Lazarus come as it did, about 15 minutes after I had just read it in the Bible, I felt mm-hmm. the back of my neck, just all those hairs raised, and I was thrilled. I had no idea what to make of this. Fortunately, I dutifully recorded it, and that and 19 others or 18 others became the core for my research and interest in trying to understand what was going on.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It was a fantastic experience. There's no question. My conclusion was, by the way,
you said, is
that
there such a
I
thing
did
as miracle,
feel that this was evidence
you got
that the world, that reality is spiritualized, and somehow or other I was able to make some kind of conscious connection with it. I think the thing that really impressed me the most was that in my relatively depressed state, it energized me and gave me a sense of hope and purpose that I could continue to go on. I had a huge problem in those days where I would sort of start and stop, and I couldn't, it was like an inefficient motor, so I couldn't keep myself energized, and I would go from positive inertia to negative inertia. And at those points where I would stop, it was beyond depression. It was a kind of spiritual despair. I felt very cynical, no sense of purpose, that I was revolving in an endless circle going nowhere. So when I had these things, among other things, it gave me a sense of purpose, meaning, wonder, awe, and like a cosmic green light.
Right, and that's great. And I think that's a really innocent, beautiful place you could stay in before you started to get your rational brain around it, but that's not what happened. You started to
now, most people, now this is interesting, because there is a graded series of steps or responses that people have with respect to these obviously meaningful events. The first is, as you say, people sort of collect these things, I call them numinosity junkies, where they essentially scratch their head and keep repeating the, you know, they collect them. It's like they're awesome, and they like feeling thrilled and awe. At the beginning of my book, I came up with, I think, a really good introduction in which I say, I want you to attend a very unusual magic show that is essentially a one-trick act. And at the beginning of the show, this magician says to the packed audience, I am going to perform one trick, and you're going to experience it, and then at the end, you're going to have a response, and then I want you to make a choice. He does the trick, and he says, I predict you're going to be thrilled out of your minds. You're going to be in awe. He performs the trick, and indeed, everybody is thrilled out of their minds. He then says, now I'm going to give you all a choice. The choice is, those who wish to stay and see the trick repeated endlessly, I will do that, and you can be as awestruck as you want to. With the other group, I will show you how the trick is done. Take your choice.
Uh-huh.
And from my vantage point, that is the key to these phenomena, that if you want to be dazzled, all you do is collect these events and go around scratching your head and be in eternal wonder and awe. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. On the other hand, mm-hmm. if you want to penetrate the mystery, as I have attempted to do in my research of 50 years, then you gradually are going to be revealed by your own experience how the trick is done, and I use trick in not a tricky way, in a scientific way, and it, of course, has benefits and liabilities. If you want the trick over and over again, you will have an endless sense of numinosity, a sense of being enveloped in mystery and a divinity. You may feel elected, that God is truly on your side. He's telling you how to be and where to go and so forth. That's fine. On the other hand, for curious people, they sort of want to know, well, is there magic? If there's magic, isn't there an explanation? So for those scientifically minded people, like I guess I was, that I wanted to see, you know, there's got to be an explanation. I just could not stay with the idea of a pure faith in the sense of a transcended faith. I felt there's got to be a cause, so that I believe I have found such a cause, which in a way gets rid of the magic, but it leads to something better, which is an understanding of the creative process.
Right, but we also may not be as expanded enough to understand the cause, like, you know, 1,000 years ago, people would see electricity. They thought that was mystical. And until other things came into place, there wasn't a plausible explanation. I don't think electricity's still been really explained, but at least we have a handle on it. But, yes, I think there's a causality, but I don't think we're in our evolutionarily there to explain it. That's my theory.
Well, let me be clear about what I'm attempting to do.
Okay.
Jung, in effect, said that there is a half explanation which can explain the inner event. And by the way, with synchronicities, there's a common structure. There's an internal psychological event that hooks up with a parallel external event, and the two are seemingly uncaused in the conventional scientific sense of causality, but they are all, or they each, internal and external, are bound together or linked together by an equivalence of meaning and simultaneity. In other words, the internal event and the external event seem meaningfully related, and they're bound together in a temporal way by seeming to happen, if not exactly simultaneously, close enough where it feels as if it's uncanny that such a thing should occur in such close proximity.
Well, wait, use your example to explain that. Use the example of your synchronicity to explain what you just named that said there.
All right. The whole experience for me, in a way, was synchronous, where going to the seance or the consciousness-raising group and Agatha saying, say what comes to mind, and I facetiously said at first, it's nothing comes to mind, it's dark. And she urged me, no, just stay with it, keep an open mind. In effect, she was saying, free associate. And suddenly, as she says, keep an open mind, this yellow ovular, I don't know what it was, hallucination, imagination, I don't know what it was, comes instantly into my mind. So in a way, it was a sort of a synchronicity. She says, I think if you make yourself open, you will get something meaningful. And voila, 2 seconds later, out comes this obviously meaningful whatever it was.
But Gibbs, can I just interrupt? Why do you deny the fact there may be some other connection to some higher causality, let's say, that came into your mind from a higher dimension? Is that possible? Do you consider that?
No, it isn't a question of why do I deny it. The truth of it is, I really, my experience was hardly denial. I became early on what I call a de facto Jungian. I didn't know there was a history of this literature to begin with. I stumbled on it in terms of my own direct experience, and I bought it. I thought that, well, I was skeptical, but I wasn't beyond the possibility. And I did approach things from a sort of intellectual point of view. When I got interested in this kind of occult, magical, mystical thing, it also led me into what I call the lure of the occult, and I started to get interested in a very deep way in esoteric occultism. So I took classes in esoteric astrology, tarot, Kabbalah. I started to read all of the important literature, Blavatsky. I really got into this deep. I met a man called Mason who used to have an occult bookshop near Bloomingdale's, walked in, introduced myself, looked for the sophisticated books on the occult, and he said, look, the phenomena is not all that important. You want to be interested in the philosophy, and the philosophy is simple. All you have to do is to make one assumption, that assumption that everything is not only connected with everything else, but that reality is spiritualized, and that everything flows from that. And just remember one occult law, as above, so below, as below, so above. Everything is ultimately connected with everything else in a spiritualized way. That's all you have to do, and you become a follower of Jung. That's essentially his thing. And Jung, indeed, was, I think, part of a rich tradition of esoteric occultism, in which spirituality, right, the occult, is very much joined together. I bought that. I lived it. I thought that made perfectly good sense to me.
When did it stop making sense to you?
It stopped making that kind of sense when I continued to become very much interested in spiritualism and the people who were involved in it. And I think because of my natural inclination to have a kind of pan-distrust, everything eventually paled as a great thing. I tended to idealize everybody and everything. And when I found things like that, I threw myself in until, on a human level, they started to disappoint me, and I started to find contradictions, which, of course, exist in everybody. And then my glow of idealizing sort of crashed. And this particular crash occurred when I was on a bus trip with a bunch of spiritual people attending a summer conference at, what's the name of that place? You had told me, Lilydale, where they have
upstate New York,
a number of demonstrations of occult things like trumpet reading and tarot and astrology, everything you can imagine. I'm on the bus, get excited about going, first time, and one of the women comes and into my right ear, and she whispers, "You are very lucky." And I said, "What am I lucky about?" And she says, "You are going to be tapped into the secret society of Saint Germain." And I went along with this, and I said, "Oh, isn't that marvelous?" Thinking to myself, "What in the hell is she talking about?" But I figured, I don't know, that I'm game. Let's go. Now, that would have been fine if it weren't for the fact that a half hour later, as I'm on the grounds going to my first demonstration, another lady comes to my left ear, and she says, "There is reason to believe that you are going to have somebody invite you into the Society of Saint Germain. Don't do it. They're a bunch of phonies, and you're going to be in trouble if you do." Well,
and she didn't know what the other woman had said, or were they all set up?
I don't know, but I thought to myself, damn, even in the world of spirit, there's the same old nonsense politics.
And well, it was people like, are people, but...
It was like the Tea Parties and the Democrats, you know, same nonsense. And I figured, I don't like this.
And well, that should destroy everything else for you, just because people will be people. I mean, you know.
You're talking rational.
No, I'm talking emotional.
You have to understand my psychology at the time was that things were either perfect or they're imperfect. You're either a friend or an enemy. I thought in dichotomous terms. That's how I experienced things. And I went from very high to very low, and that's the way I operated. I would not be that way today. I'm not that way. However, I was then. So that's what I did with it. So I figured, I started to get suspicious. So my skeptical side really started to question what's going on. Now, as a result of that, and I'm glad that happened, because that then immersed me in the literature of synchronicities, and I found this marvelous book by Arthur Koestler. If anybody's interested, a very good introduction to synchronicities is what is his name of his book? I forgot the name. It's a little paperback.
Oh,
by
is it something
Kessler,
called the Frog? Something called the Prince Frog? Is that part of it? I think
what?
I know. I think
the
I
Roots
do
of Coincidence.
Know.
It's a brilliant little introduction. In any event, as that introduces me to Jung, and I read everything that he had to say about synchronicities, and
which wasn't original because Jung took it from
about
that
a rational explanation of these things is not even possible. Now, what he did, in order to stave off the idea that he was going to be laughed out of the scientific world, don't forget, Jung was Freud's heir apparent, and that he would have been tapped into becoming the titular head of the psychoanalytic movement had it not been for a major dust-up between him and Freud, and interestingly, over part of it being a major difference in interpretation of a synchronicity that they shared together in Freud's library. However, getting back to Jung...
Well, I think that's very interesting, though, because that synchronicity was the break between them. But then you went on to tell me that if Freud could do his whole career over, he would have been a parapsychologist, where he would have maybe looked into this. I just thought that was an interesting...
When Freud and Jung meet... In 1909, I believe it was, in Freud's library, yeah. Freud was on the verge of anointing Jung with the titular head of the psychoanalytic movement. Among other things, Jung was getting increasingly interested in the occult and was on the pre-side of formulating his ideas of what came to be the collective unconscious and so forth. And he's very excited, and he tells Freud some of his increasing interest in the occult, and Freud, being Freud, who was really very skeptical about this stuff and felt that Jung was obviously enthusiastic and interesting and interested, but felt he was getting a bit wifty and that he was straying from the basic tenets of psychic determinism, which is the foundations of psychoanalytic theory. So Freud says, look, do me a favor. Don't get too carried away in the black mud of occultism. Well, that's all that Jung had to hear. Both of these guys were very ego-filled. They both felt they were absolutely right about whatever they thought. And they were competing. And but, Jung wants Freud to be his good father, and Freud, and the good father is putting down his son, and Jung gets really angry. And as he's getting angry, suddenly in the library there's a sound of a large clapping sound. And Freud says, "What's that?" And Jung said, "That's an example of what I mean," and he was talking about some kind of catalytic exteriorization phenomena. So this thing happens, this loud report, and both are shocked, and Jung says, "That's an example of what I mean." Freud says, "Bosh, you know, don't get so wifty. You know, come back down to terra firma." At which point, Jung really gets angry and describes in his autobiography that his chest was like a glowing vault of red-hot metal. That is a poetic way of saying he was very pissed off, and says in the autobiography, without having any idea how he knew this, he said, "And I'll prove it, it's going to happen again." And the same thing happened exactly as he predicted, and Freud is really impressed and says, "Wow." Now, Freud was not at that time a believer in esoteric stuff, though he was interested. And they do have a rich communication in letters of Freud and Jung that goes on for the next 2-3 years, in which that particular event is brought up on a number of times. And Freud, being Freud, was initially impressed, but then he's in his study one day and is trying to understand what happened, and it was a summertime, and aperiodically he would hear the same sound come out of the bookcases, and deduced that particular sound happens at certain times when the weather must dry the wood, and the wood snaps. So that at least explains how that happened, but it didn't explain the timing of it. And Jung and Freud's explanation was, look, these things happen. Sometimes a coincidence is just a coincidence, and if you combine it with heightened attention and the timing is right, then it seems to be a meaningful coincidence. All right, point being, over time, Jung's influence in terms of the esoteric occult must have indeed penetrated Freud, because Freud starts to do investigations of telepathy and actually discovered or came to the conclusion that of all the occult pathways, that telepathy is absolutely real, and that he had to hide it because he felt that if he makes it public, that people already thought that psychoanalysis with their idea of infantile sexuality was absurd and that they'd be the laughing stock, so he kept it quiet. However, he wrote a letter to Lord Harrington, he said, "If I had my life to live over again, I most likely would have been a parapsychologist." So that at the end of his life, he was very much interested, and I think that Jung's particular interest must have rubbed off. Mm. Getting back, however, to my thing, I became aware that Jung made a lot of assumptions that, if you change the assumptions, now getting back, remember I said Mason said, all you have to do is make one major assumption that everything is connected and that it all radiates from a central purpose, I mean a central point. And that point that he calls spiritualized is what Jung and the Jungians refer to as the unus mundus. And everything comes back from there, or is derived from there. Now, having had a philosophy background, which I found very valuable, I began to realize, all right, that's one assumption you can make of reality, but that's not the only one in town. You can reverse all of that and say, look, there is nothing. It's all random. Or maybe it isn't random, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a spiritualized unity. And then if you do that, then you begin to see that the debate between Freud and Jung is really a part of an historical debate between Plato and Aristotle, and seeing synchronicities from the basis of understanding fundamental assumptions about the nature of reality and the way we access knowledge of reality, you get two entirely different theories of synchronicity. So essentially, my theory was taking the basic assumptions that Jung made and his organizing concepts and begin to see them from a naturalistic position, not assuming that everything is spiritualized. Now, what is the truth of it? I don't know. But all I do know is, in tracing it in my particular way, I have found a naturalistic approach to these very incredible coincidences.
And
it depends upon the predilection of the observer as to which way they're going to go. I do not pretend to have the truth of the matter. All I am saying is that I have an alternative which does make sense in utilizing my particular perspective, and then there may be others. But at least I think I have a viable alternative.
And does that alternative really fill in all the pieces, or are you fudging the anomalous stuff a little bit just to kind of...
Well, all I can tell you is... Oh, here, I'm glad you're asking the question. I don't purport to try to understand how the parallel external event comes into view at particularly the time that it does. However, what I do say is that instead of conventional causality that A leads to B, what I do say is that B's are out there and that we connect to them when A is ready to connect. So that, briefly, my theory is that these things, that the preconditions for synchronicities, and I have attempted to objectify this by utilizing... Let me backtrack for a second. This is critical.
Okay.
Jung says you can't really make a science of these things because of three anti-scientific or anti-causal arguments. The first one is the critical one. The first one says, because you experience synchronicities as if they're firefly flashes, that they just happen. They seem to happen randomly. They occur. You look at the flash, you react, you scratch your head, you're in awe, it's a great mystery, and you say it's a cosmic green light or whatever your particular implications are. But you can't pin them down. In order to make a science out of it, you've got to be able to bring it into the laboratory under control conditions, take a look at it, and see that their conditions are always similar and that A always leads to B and that you're able to objectify it. Well, he's right, except he's not right. Because fortunately, I had discovered, or fortunately, I was able to have my journal. And in the journal, unlike a diary, I would put down things that mattered to me, what questions, observations, associations, dreams, whatever it was. So I had a context for when synchronicities occur. So when a given synchronicity would occur, I dated it, and I stuck it into the ongoing flow of my personal experience. Now, why is that important? Because in my research... Freud said that even though he didn't understand how these things worked, he said ultimately psychoanalytic explanation is probably going to make the occult understandable. Then I read somebody else, another psychoanalyst who was studying this stuff. She said ultimately these things all have a context, and if you can see them within the personal context of a person's stream of experience, ultimately you'll be able to interpret them. So I took these ideas, I thought about the immediate context, social context, psychological context, the long-term genetic context of the past, and other context, and I began to look at, I found a method by which maybe you could objectively understand these things if you see them not as simply occurrences, but see them as occurrences in a context. A personal context. Now, what did I find? I found that, and this is on the examination of my 19, and I've had patients in treatment who I would call synchronicity prone, who offered me, without asking, journals which contained their important synchronicities. So I have four or five patients who have had a number of these things, so this became my population of trying to understand these things from an objective point of view. And I discovered in all cases, and of course anybody's listening to this and interested in doing it, instantly start keeping a journal, and when you have synchronicities, date it, take a look at it from a look at it in terms of context, and here's what I found. That when people have synchronicities, if you examine it from the vantage point of their personal context in the journals, they will find, inevitably, that they all begin in the context of a particularly complicated problem that seems to admit of no answer, that all answers are do not do justice to the problem. At that point, they will tend to reach what I call quintessential stuckness or psychological gridlock. Now, what becomes critical is the person's attitude to the stuckness. Most of the time, it's one of passivity or giving up or resignation, drinking themselves to death, psychological suicide, what have you. It's like resigned and it's no more, end of matter. Or there is a stimulation by the person to try to find an answer, even if they're pessimistic. So they launch out on a search to struggle with struggle to somehow come up with an answer if it's possible. What I believe happens is that search, that dedicated search for the truth of the, or to a pathway to resolve their seemingly unresolvable problem, turns on their idiosyncratic creative process. What's the creative process? From my vantage point, it is starting a psychological scavenger hunt where you're looking for clues, as if each clue is like a piece of a jigsaw puzzle, and that each clue, when you find it, as like a jigsaw puzzle, you start to put the pieces together, and when you put the pieces together and they form a recognizable pattern, that pattern, as soon as it's recognized, is the equivalent of a synchronicity, which tells you that the problem that you have been searching for however long, could be a long time, has been found, but it's in coded form, so you have to interpret it like a waking dream. So bottom line, what am I saying? That these, it is no coincidence when a person has a coincidence, and it is a marker of a seemingly unresolved problem, and that the problem is going to be in the form of a coded synchronicity, which has to be interpreted, and that ultimately these synchronicities, these meaningful coincidences, are generated self-messages. They do not come from spirit. They come from your personal unconscious and the attempt to find answers through what I call experiential logic, in which you actually find an answer, and more importantly, when you find it, it always leads to an expansion of consciousness and is reflected in in areas of being and doing, where on a being level, your incohesive self becomes more integrated, and in terms of doing things, that which tends to be fragmented starts to become harnessed in your abilities, start to take the form of a greater liveliness, a greater interest, a greater sense of confidence, and usually leads to an ability to connect with your own creative process. I have interpreted hundreds of these things, and it tends to be. Now, could there also be a connection? Could there still be a connection with a so-called spiritualized reality? Sure. Why not? I'm open to that. But well, I don't think that's necessary.
Well, it doesn't really explain a lot of the other synchronicities that seem to pop up, like three people with the same name calling me within an hour, or the addresses that I grew up with all had a 38 in that number of the address in three different locations, or the associations between the Kennedy assassination and the Lincoln assassination. There's hundreds of things that
I know what you're saying. However, let me give you an answer which I think is important.
Okay.
According to me, you would have to first in order to make your assertion that there's something extra more,
yeah.
you would have to be able to keep a journal, and when you get a run of 38, 38, 38, see where those 38s fit with respect to your ongoing psyche. And I am inclined to think that because you are having a heightened attention to the repetition of the number 38,
mm-hmm.
if there's, in all likelihood, that 38 is not random and that it may well connect with your psyche. You could, why 38? Why not 52? Why not 97 and a half?
Well, that could be the universe giving us a...
You always add something of yourself when you are aware of any particular fact or any particular experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, this whole explanation seems to be trying to squeeze a very big idea and topic into a very small psychological explanation. I mean, how do you explain the Kennedy-Lincoln coincidences?
You are quite right that there are all sorts of parallels between that particular one. I'll give you another one. There's a whole field of biblical text which says, I guess based upon the idea of the Kabbalah, that with the numerical thing, which is the basis for numerology, that every word, every letter is attached to a particular vibration, and if you add up the... numbers in every word, you will come out with a particular vibratory thing, and that it's been shown that with respect to Old Testament stuff, that it's like, who's that guy who made all those predictions?
Nostradamus?
Nostradamus, that there's other kind of predictions that says you look at biblical text, you take anything, and it'll predict half of the stuff that goes on yesterday morning. And,
right.
and it looks like it looks like it might work. I don't know how to explain that. All I know is that we are creatures who are able to make meaning out of anything. We look for patterns, and that I do know that those patterns are idiosyncratic. Do you know the phenomenon of what is it called when you look reversible images? There's an image that is psychologically used where you look at a particular image and it looks like two women who are facing each other, an older woman and a younger woman. If you look, if you reverse figure and ground, the image will appear as if it is a candlestick. It's the same thing, but if you approach it from a different point of view, you connect the dots in a different way and you wind up with an entirely different experience. I believe that that is what is happening in synchronicities, that essentially we're dealing with the phenomenon of generating meaning, and you can make meaning out of anything, and the meaning that you make is going to be idiosyncratic to what the self brings to it. That's what we do as human beings.
We make meaning as human beings, although I do like what you quoted Jung saying in the, you know, in the beginning of the show, where there's a sort of transcendent quality that's a kind of universal meaning to something. Can you repeat that quote? Because do you know what I mean? You said there's implicit meaning in the nature of course.
See the assumptions about some of the questions that I started to raise was, since meaning is the key to this, that synchronicities are bound together seemingly not by cause and effect, but by an equivalence of meaning. What Jung does not really go into is what is the meaning of meaning. He assumes that there is a realm of absolute meaning. What is absolute meaning? Now, this is critical. He makes the assumption that under certain conditions, people are able to plug into this realm of absolute meaning that you know is absolute because it bypasses interpretation. From my vantage point, that is sheer nonsense, that nobody is able to transcend, that even if there was such a level, if there was such a thing, I think that different people would experience the so-called absolute world of meaning differentially. You can't you can't trump yourself. You are a slave to your own particular experience. I do believe that there is something, I don't think everything's relative. I think certain things are more relative than others, or there is an objectivity that some people are more objective than others. Nevertheless, you can't trump your own personal experience in making meaning out of anything. So that people will disagree. Those who believe, as Jung does, that there is this realm of absolute meaning, and in synchronicities, you're seemingly tapping into it, and it's a non-intellectual apprehension of this. He says you're gripped by numinosity. So he definitely is dealing with a strong feeling of awe and mystery. That's how you deal with these things. From my vantage point, he leaves out critical thinking, and when you start to plug in critical thinking, then you get an entirely different view of what's going on.
Yeah, that's the problem. The critical thinking takes away from the mystery of life and tries to put it in a box, and the awe and translucentness of the experience is really what it's all about.
Go back to the magic show, you're perfectly correct. If you learn the trick, as a kid learning a magic trick, there is a sense of intellectual mastery. Great, I knew there was a trick, now I know how it's done. But you get disappointed because it takes the sizzle out. I understand that. But, if you go further and you believe that these are self-generated messages from the connection of the personal unconscious, your own consciousness, and your attempt to resolve a tricky issue in a very creative way, I believe that what adequately substitutes for the sizzle is a connection with your creative process. Now, I can't explain the creative process. I think that's amazing to me. I think that from my vantage point, and I know what the sizzle is. I love that sizzle. For me,
well, maybe
I like taking responsibility for that and feeling that the creative process is ultimately, for me, equally as good as any transcendent sizzle.
Well, maybe what you're calling the creative process, what other people might call the transcendent self or the higher self or the collective.
Yeah, but I think they're fudging, because if I'm right, when you are sizzled in the way of connecting with this realm of absolute meaning, you are gripped with what he says is numinosity. You feel that the world is a magical, mystical place, and that you are getting connected with divinity, and you are getting, you know, messages from whatever this is, and it leads to things like master teachers and channeling all this ancient wisdom and so forth. That's fine. That's fine. Here, bottom line, glad you asked me this. Bottom line, I think the critical issue is who is the final authority in a person's life. If you start getting involved with things that are transcendent and you assume that there's a world of absolute meaning, then indeed you do channel. You do say there's a source greater than me,
No, you do say the source that is greater than the personality is the divine aspect of myself. It's my higher connection, or however you want to call it. It's nothing greater than us. That's the old-time religion. The new spirituality says, no, we are the source of that channeling, the part of us that's eternal. You see, you're putting the spirituality...
I no argument. I'll accept that. You win. I'll accept that. That's okay.
Okay.
I have no problem with that.
But what you're calling the creative process, I do agree, could be... But when you say that, in a way, you're not giving an explanation. You're just
What I think it's an important distinction is that from my vantage point, let's go along with the Jungian thing. From my vantage point, when you start talking in terms of archetypes and archetypal meanings and so forth, to me, it's fudging. It's getting away from what I call person-specific information. For example, Jung is with a patient, the famous scarab synchronicity.
That's right,
which is
yeah.
The first one that gets him really involved for the rest of his life in trying to understand these things. So he's with this woman who's basically uptight. She's too mannish. She's obsessive compulsive. She needs to be in absolute control. She can't relax and enjoy herself. They get bogged down in therapy. he thinks to himself, he writes out, this woman needs to be shocked in some way so she can penetrate her rigid defenses. She comes in the next day and brings him a dream, and the dream essentially is that she is handed a golden scarab, which is a particular kind of color brooch, and she's handed a golden scarab by a man. As she is relating this dream, Jung is sitting by a window, hears a tap, and looks, and because he is very knowledgeable in botany among tens of other knowledge bases, the guy was quite brilliant, he opens the window, sees that the tapping is due to a beetle, but it's a particular kind of beetle. He knows it's a scarab beetle because it has the colors of the scarab coloration.
Mm-hmm.
Puts the beetle in his hand, goes over to the woman, takes her hand, and says, here's your scarab. She presumably has a psychodynamic orgasm, and you get the sense that she was flooded with what he calls numinosity. It broke through her defenses, and presumably she has this unbelievable experiential epiphany and makes major changes. Now, interesting story. However, using critical thinking, it's very interesting that Jung, who recorded everything, has written voluminous notes and dates everything, failed to date this particular experience that he says was the most important synchronicity of his lifetime. He does contradict himself, but that started the ball going. That's interesting. So interesting, I wrote to a woman who wrote a definitive biography, 700-page biography, the last couple of years, and I mentioned that, and I said, do you understand this? She wrote back, and she said, you know, you're absolutely right. It's a very interesting fact. She has no idea why he did not date it. It seems to be around 1925.
Uh-huh.
In addition,
what does that have to do with the synchronicity?
Particular notes as to what happens to the patient over time. That's also interesting. My hunch is nothing happened. That she slid right back into her defenses. You don't know that.
He may never have seen her again. You're just guessing. That's not fair to Jung or the audience to say that you're. Your hunches. I mean, that doesn't mean anything, your hunch. I will
go along with the idea that it was not dated, and I'm suspicious, but I don't think we care about her. What becomes important from my vantage point, it was a shared synchronicity, and whereas it may or may not have been illuminating for her, and maybe she turned into a hot tamale, I don't know. Fine for her. More importantly, really meant something to Jung enough to energize him to take these things seriously and investigate them for the rest of his life. I think it was basically Jung's synchronicity. And
well, I think it's both. Partly what happens, synchronicities can be shared.
Sure.
And I think perhaps, so if let's say, go ahead, if it was Jung's synchronicity, then his whatever creative process caused that to manifest?
I think what happens is that for him, in terms of the context, he was striving to take his very interesting ideas, and he was trying, they were sort of disparate, and they were like pieces. And he's, in order to be, to arrive at a new theory, you got to take the concepts that you come up with, and your hunches, and your ideas, and your experiences, and at some point, you have to start to synthesize them. I believe what happens with people who are like this is that synchronicities mark that a synthesis of previously split off ideas, feelings, and so forth are conjoined in a meaningful way, and that the synchronicity is a marker that the synthetic part of the ego is synthesizing, and that what happens is it gives a certain validity. You have a way of organizing the material, you're able to describe it and utilize it. And if you look at the progression of Jung's experiences as he goes through his life, virtually every time he has one of these, he is having his own theory evolving, and he becomes increasingly more confident that what he has is real.
Okay, but that still doesn't explain how that beetle, which is exactly what the woman described in the dream, showed up at the window. I mean,
I am presuming that
doesn't make any sense.
Oh, wait a minute! I'm glad you mentioned this. More importantly, when Jung and that beetle thing, he says to the woman, he says to her, "You know, let me tell you what this is all about. This synchronicity for you is that the scarab beetle in both your dream and the parallel equivalent a beetle a tapping, that these two things coming together, which is amounts to a shared synchronicity for the two of them, is vitally important to Jung because he believes that synchronicities are activated archetypal knowledge. And he says the beetle is a symbol of rebirth. It's an ancient Egyptian symbol for rebirth. All right, now, try this. I subscribe that if he had been more Freudian and had said to the woman, you know, you're very excited, I can understand that, you dreamed it, and it's almost like it was telepathy or you foretold that this was going to happen. That's exciting in and of itself. However, what's the special meaning of this to you? What is this really all about? He didn't do that. He interprets it as she's in touch with an archetype of a Egyptian symbol for rebirth. I believe, my hunch is, and I'll stand by this hunch, though I can't prove it, if he had said to her, is this symbolic of something? She would not have said, it's an ancient symbol of Egyptian rebirth. Nonsense. More importantly,
well, but he was giving you the universal meaning. I mean, maybe she didn't know what it meant. I mean,
I'll give you a more simple meaning. Here's what I mean by person-specific. I think she was in love with Jung. She had a very positive transference. He gives her a gift. He gives her a gift, her therapist. He touches her, which is usually verboten in analytic work because the touch can be extraordinarily, you know, important and seductive on many levels. However, I think I think he was like a father transference. You know, this man who she idealized.
But you're hypothesizing and subsuming, and I think, and I'm looking at it from a broader point of view, perhaps the universe, whatever that is, was giving them a message and saying, you're right on. Here's a confirmation of this experience, and it connects us to a higher order of things. Instead of trying to fit it into a psychological box, the mystery unfolds into a greater awareness that I think when we do evolve to these greater points of consciousness, we will understand the synchronicities. It's like we're living in a two-dimensional world and we're seeing these three-dimensional experiences. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I have no problem with that. It may indeed be complementary, but from where I am and where I went through, from my vantage point, viewing these things and a very personal and evolutionary way, somehow, for me, feels more meaningful. I have no problem.
It feels more meaningful. You call it, you know, creative process, and Jung called it synchronicity. And the Freudians wouldn't even have noticed it. They said, oh, that's interesting, and they would have went on. So I think the Jungian understanding expanded upon this interaction. I mean, let's say a Jungian was there listening to this woman's dream and the beetle showed up. They would not have given it any notice, which would have kind of excluded a big part of reality and not and just called it anomalous, which is what a lot of people do with things they can't explain. Instead of trying to include it.
That's why I go from linear logic to experiential, and I think you're absolutely right. I think I also think, by the way, that Jung and Freud were really coming at this experience from two different vantage points. Freud's population essentially were neurotics, meaning they had fairly well-defined selves, and they were all screwed up with respect to, like, sexuality. Is it permissible, or it's sinful, or what have you? Whereas Jung essentially is talking about pre-Oedipal experience with split selves who are divided which are divided. If depending upon who you're talking about, synchronicities as well as any experience is going to serve different functions. I also have a belief or a hunch that there may be different classes of synchronicities and that I don't pretend to have the last word, although I sound somewhat militant. I'm not. I'm really open-minded. I see what I'm doing as a service to broadening the whole idea, and that there are various approaches to, of which I have, a valid approach, and there may be others, and I think there may be levels of these things. And I'm not against the idea that there may indeed be something Jung proposes. It, frankly, at this particular moment, having seen his biography out of which he comes, and any theorist obviously is limited by his own self, and when you look at in the book, I detail that it is no coincidence that Jung became that he searched for meaningful coincidences because he had a divided self. He wanted to feel that there was something above and beyond. It was necessary. Mm-hmm. And he says at one point, in contrast to Freud, he says there's got to be something better and more meaningful that transcends earthly behavior. If not, you might as well put, I'm paraphrasing, you might as well put a bullet in your head, because this is a world essentially of disappointment and ambivalence and negativity. You know, who needs it? There's got to be something better out there. Whereas Freud says, the end of a good analysis, to paraphrase, is an acceptance of converting neurotic suffering into an acceptance of everyday common misery. That's an entirely different experience of what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I get that. I get that they had differences, and
this is cigarette smokers and non-cigarette smokers. And
I'm putting
it in a
larger context.
It's okay. You know, there's room for both.
I'm putting it in a much larger context.
There is a viable alternative, and people are going to latch on to one or the other depending upon their favorite.
It's
365-page therapies.
Gibbs, it's not one or the other. I'm saying there's a much larger context. It's not Freudian or Jungian.
It's complementary.
It's much bigger than all this. That's coming into this understanding of our the connection of consciousness itself. No, I mean, Jung saying it's synchronicity, he's just renaming what he learned from Kamermar, who said called it surreality.
Right.
I'm saying the universe, the conscious entity of the universe, is speaking to us all the time through these synchronicities, and I think that is an aspect of ourselves. You can call it the creative process, but it expands the human to include so much more of who we really are. That's what my explanation is.
I don't think there's really any difference in our perspectives. I think it's a tweaking of what concept, and what do you do with it? Here, let's say you got five people who have a synchronicity. A large part of the issue, it seems to me, is and let's include your idea that it's really transcendent, it's bigger, it's more important, there is wisdom and so forth. You still can't get away from the individual interpreting what it is, and what do you do with it? What's the cash value?
Well, it's not the cash value.
Some people are going to be very expanding.
In each instant, the universe is talking to you. So. You know, if something happens and it's synchronistic with the scarab beetle and it turns Jung on to rebirth, then yeah, that was a...
Here's what I would do with this. Does the universe talk to everybody?
Yes, it does. Not everyone's aware of it. I mean, that's why astrology works.
So
that's why tarot
So you're on a continuum of more or less awareness. That's fine. Now, what do you do? I just got finished seeing a Nova whatever it was on Channel 13, of these peasants in Guatemala who come to the United States and work for like $7 an hour and have a reasonably good job, and they're able to eke out a living, send half of it back to Guatemala, and there was a major raid and exported all these people back to Guatemala, and they have virtually no money, and they carry this terrible weight of stuff on their shoulders, and they look miserable, and they're going to be that way the rest of their lives. Who's speaking to them?
who's speaking to them.
Yeah, what's the world, what's the universe saying to them?
Well, you could take lots of instances. You could take lots of instances that doesn't have anything to do with you or me and try to explain a miserable world that way. But let's take your synchronicity. Let's take mine. I don't know what to do. I mean, who knows what's their reality? I can't hypothesize that. All I know is the synchronicities I've been aware of do have meaning for me. And yes, it's the meaning I make it, but I'm saying there's something bigger. Maybe it's a creative force. I understand we're sort of saying the same thing, but I'm not couching it in a psychological modality. I'm just saying it's more this higher spiritual directive.
Let's talk more practical. Don't
all right,
forget,
we have to wrap it up though soon, but yeah.
The context that I'm using this is as a psychoanalyst who has very little time, 45 minutes, with a patient, and that time, that's a whisper, that goes real quick, so that when somebody comes in and, let's say, presents a synchronicity, I have to make conscious choices as to, A, do I pick up on it at all? How do I pick up on it? What's the treatment? What are we going to talk about? You know, and it seems to me, from my experience, having been also in under analysis three times, the first two of which were failures. The third one worked because I feel that the therapist always consulted me, did not tell me what was going on. He said, what do you think is going on? What is the meaning of this to you? And in so doing, my split self became increasingly more cohesive. I started to feel like I was a human being instead of an object that was being told what to do or how to feel or what the therapist thought. And it was over this consistent experience of treating me as an equal and a respected equal who was obviously, he knew more, but
right.
Not as two people, we were equals as people. Over that experience, what do you feel? What is the meaning of this to you? I literally experienced myself going from fragments to cohesive, from going
right.
From devitalized to vitalized. And I regard myself as
that's
an extremely
experience
spiritual
you,
person.
But
I am not anti-spiritual, but I do believe that my spirituality is what I would refer to as a grounded spirituality. That transcendence for me, in reading a paper the other day by a great therapist by the name of Gargiulo, who's a ex-priest, he talks about transcendence of everyday common experience. I love that. And to me, mystery and spirituality has to do, I think you and I will agree with this, in having an appreciation for that which is greater, the unknown. I came upon a picture that I'm going to show in my next presentation by Paul Klee called The Red Balloon. And it's a combination of light, bright colors of buildings with a red
mm-hmm.
balloon, which is all vivid, like primary crayon colors, like seeing reality through the eyes of a 2-year-old. But
mm-hmm.
it's got a patch of dark black, two patches of dark black. And for me, it's striking in contrast. Those patches of blackness, to me, are like the lure of the occult. It's the mysterious. It's the spiritual. It's something higher and bigger and beckons me to keep on searching for something beyond myself. That, to me, is what I think spirituality is.
Well, thank you. I do agree with that. And thanks for
laying
theory tonight. I do want to say that Gibbs will be continuing this discussion on May 21st at the Open Center in New York at 22 East 30th Street at 7 p.m., sponsored by the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. And you can look on their website. What's their website? ASP.com. There's a phone number, 516-829-5027.
By the way, there will be me and two Jungians. It's the first time I will be meeting them, and I hope they don't bring a red book and crush me.
No. But thank you. I do appreciate, I know I don't agree with all of it, and I think you have made some good points. And thank you for sharing your wisdom.
My pleasure. I'm glad you asked, and we'll meet again.
I'll talk to you this week, okay?
Great.
Thanks. Thanks, Gibbs Williams. And Gibbs, what's your website?
I guess there are two, GibbsOnline.com, and they also have another website called Meaningful Little Line Coincidences.com.
Thank you. Thanks for being a guest on New Realities.
Thank you.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net and check my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.